From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The new HBO documentary Frederick Douglass in Five Speeches is about the 19th century abolitionist and orator. Today, our interview with David Blight, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography that inspired the documentary.
Seeing and hearing Douglass became, through the course of the 19th century, a kind of American wonder of the world. If you came to America, you wanted to see Douglass speak if you could. It was that kind of an event.
Also, we remember the beloved physician and anthropologist Paul Farmer, who dedicated his life to providing health care to the poor in Haiti, Rwanda, and other countries. He died Monday. And Justin Chang reviews the new film Cyrano, a musical starring Peter Dinklage. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. This week, HBO premiered a new documentary about 19th century abolitionist and orator Frederick Douglass. It features several distinguished actors reading from Douglass's speeches and his autobiographies. Here's actress Nicole Beharie reading from Douglass's 1852 speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July.
What do I or those I represent have to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and natural justice embodied in that declaration extended to us? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than any other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mock. The existence of slavery in this country brands your humanity as base pretense and your Christianity as a lie.
The documentary, titled Frederick Douglass in Five Speeches, is inspired by historian David Blight's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Douglass. Today we'll listen to some of my 2018 interview with Blight, who's a professor of history at Yale. Blight's book deals with Douglass's autobiographies, which describe his escape from slavery to freedom, but it also illuminates less well-known parts of Douglass's long and remarkable life, his break with abolitionist William Lord Garrison, his complicated personal life, his support for and bitter feud with leaders of the women's suffrage movement, and his years as a Republican Party functionary when he took patronage jobs in the government. Douglass was a powerful orator, and Blight says the most photographed person of the 19th century. Blight's book is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Well, David Blight, welcome back to Fresh Air. Tell us about Frederick Douglass' early life. Where was he born? What was his life like as a slave?
Well, first, thank you, Dave. It's great to be back on Fresh Air. Frederick Douglass was born along a horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe River on the eastern shore of Maryland in 1818. It's a kind of a remote backwater at that point of the American Slave Society. He was born on the Home Hill Farm, which was owned by his then master, Aaron Anthony. His mother was a still young woman named Harriet Bailey. He was probably born in his grandmother Betsy Bailey's cabin, although we don't know for sure. And he never will know exactly who his father was, although one candidate is Aaron Anthony himself. Douglass was always told that his father was his master, or one of his masters. So one of the facts of his youth that everyone should know is that he was, in essence, an orphan. He never knew his father, and he never saw his mother after the age of six, and he had to practically invent images of her. He had very little memory of her. So as a child, he's essentially not altogether abandoned, but he's left without parents. And then he grows up for 20 years as a slave, about 11 of them on the Eastern Shore, and about 9 of those years in Baltimore, which, in fact, the city has everything to do with the fact that he would ever be able to escape.
Right. In Baltimore, he lived among a lot of freed black men, right, and women.
That's right. That's right. Baltimore was a great ocean port and a great shipbuilding city. And when in the year he escaped, 1838, Baltimore had about 130,000 people. It was a big ocean port city. It only had about 3,000 slaves, but it had about 17,000 free blacks. It was a very large, very active, energetic, free black community, and he grows up amidst them as well, especially amidst them. And it's there that he would have met Anna Murray, who became his first wife, probably when he was 18 or 19. He got involved in three or four different churches. He was involved in a debating society. And he had a relative freedom of movement within the city on its confines. But he also had this visual and emotional and imaginative window on the world with the ocean port, with all the great ships that would come in and out of Baltimore Harbor. And it's there that he discovered his literacy and his eventual genius with words and language. It's there where he first began to cultivate his abilities as an orator and even probably his abilities as a writer.
Right. He was fortunate in that Sophia Auld, who was the wife of his then owner, started mm-hmm. teaching him the alphabet, and he built on that and learned to read kind of in an enterprising way with other sources. How did he come to escape? Can't have been easy.
No, it wasn't easy. It was a brave plan. He hatched it with Anna, his fiancée at the time, as well as a few other people, clearly, who were in on the planning. He got on a train in late August, 1838, and by three train rides and three boat rides across rivers, he ended up in New York City in about 38 hours at the base of Chambers Street, right down in the lower Manhattan on the Hudson River side. It was an extraordinary escape through what one might call the Underground Railroad, but he did this essentially all on his own with Anna's help.
They made their way to Massachusetts. Was it New Bedford? Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then?
The whaling town.
Right. He works and ends up becoming quite an orator at an early age. How did that happen?
Well, he'd already practiced oratory even while he was a slave. And it gave the young Douglas, the teenager, a source of power, a source of something he was good at. He was good at getting on his feet and just trying to speak. Now, he wasn't well-formed yet by any means, but when he gets to New Bedford, he's 21, 22, and 23 years old. They lived there 3 years. He worked down in the docks. He worked in a foundry. He did all kinds of odd jobs, but he very quickly joined the local AME Zion Church, a black church, and within a year or so, they had him preaching. They said, this kid can preach. Put him up front. And he then learns to preach from the text, which is, of course, the Protestant tradition. And it's there in that AME Zion Church, as well as a couple public meetings, where he gets discovered, so to speak, by the Massachusetts abolitionists who are disciples of William Lloyd Garrison. And in the late summer of 1841, they invited this very young man, he's 23 years old, out to Nantucket to a big anti-slavery convention. And it was there in the Athenaeum on Nantucket where he gave his first speech to a room full of abolitionists, a room full of white people. And in essence, he got up and told some of his stories about his youth, about being a slave. And he was a hit, a huge hit. And they hired him to then go out on the road as an itinerant lecturer across New England at first, and eventually within a year or two, all across the northern states.
He eventually becomes and establishes several newspapers, and for the next 20 years becomes an activist for abolition. He began with a pacifist, as Garrison was. How did Frederick Douglass's views about the means to abolish slavery evolve between then and the Civil War?
Yes, that's a fascinating aspect of his life, because he undergoes a kind of ideological, strategic, even intellectual transformation in the late 1840s, early 1850s. I think it's the first great transformation of his public life. He also had quite a breakdown in this period. He could barely make ends meet for his family. He's trying to be the self-made man who could not provide. But he embraced, for example, things like the possible uses of violence. And that's in the wake, one must know, of the Fugitive Slave Act, which radicalized a lot of people. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 made everyone complicitous with returning fugitive slaves to their owners if they could be found. And by 1851, 1852, Douglass is writing editorials with lines such as, "Why do slave catchers fear having their throats cut? It's because they deserve to have them cut." He also embraced political parties vehemently. He came to see that if you don't attack the law and you don't find a way to change the power at the base of slavery, you would never destroy it. So he's moving, not only moving away from Garrison, he's moving full force into the politics of anti-slavery. It's not going to be a smooth ride by any means through the 1850s, but by 51 and 52, he's become a thoroughgoing political abolitionist, believing in political parties, believing in political activism. And I also should say here that this moment, when he does have a real emotional breakdown, he spent days at a time bedridden, even with paralytic limbs, he said, and he couldn't even work on the newspaper. It's also a period in which he wrote some of his greatest works, which has probably been true of lots of great writers, but it is certainly true of Douglas.
As he becomes a celebrated author and speaker, he has a wife, Anna, who never learns to read and write, right? What was that relationship like as far as we
know? Well, over time it became very difficult. One has to be honest about it. The man who becomes the most famous African-American writer, orator, intellectual in the world was married to a woman who remained largely illiterate. She did not share his intellectual life or his professional life. Anna almost never traveled with him. And he traveled all the time as an itinerant orator. So it became with time a very traditional marriage. Anna ran the house. She was a brilliant domestic woman. But as a marriage in which he could share his intellectual curiosity and enormous ambition, that was not that kind of marriage. Douglas never wrote much of anything about Anna in his 1,200 pages of autobiography. There's one mention of his wife Anna, and she's called my wife. He also didn't write much about his children, at least in the autobiographies. We have a lot of letters where we can get at those relationships, but Douglas did not discuss his more personal standing in his life in his many, many pages of autobiography.
Historian David Blight recorded in 2018. His Pulitzer Prize-winning book is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to my 2018 interview with historian David Blight. This week, HBO premiered a new documentary about Frederick Douglass, inspired by Blight's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. He would continue to be a great orator throughout his career. He lived until the age of 77. We have no recordings of Frederick Douglass. I imagine in all the years you spent working on this, you must have wished you could have heard him. Do you have an idea in your head of what he might have sounded like?
Well, we know a lot about what he sounded like from the way people described him. He had a deep baritone, we're told. He could modulate it a lot of different ways. There are many, many written descriptions. I have lots of clippings from local newspapers around the country of people describing the first time they saw Douglas or heard Douglas, what he sounded like, what he looked like. So we know a fair amount about that, but we also know a lot about the nature of his rhetoric just from reading it. He was terrific at this craft of starting out a speech slowly, calmly, you know, restfully, drawing an audience into some kind of situation, but nothing flamboyant about it. But then slowly, but surely, working toward some kind of resolution, some kind of point, some kind of argument, some kind of moral message. And then sometimes in that last part of a speech, reaching these exuberant crescendos that would just come out of him in shouts or in roars, people would say. He had that ability of performance, and he gained that by the simple, you know, power of repetition. But he had a performative way of delivering his oratory that people just flocked to see. In fact, I say in the book at one point that Seeing and Hearing Douglas became, through the course of the 19th century, a kind of American wonder of the world. If you came to America, you wanted to see Douglas speak, if you could. It was that kind of an event.
Douglas watched the crises over slavery build towards the Civil War. He was prepared to see a war in order to see slavery ended. What was his attitude towards Abraham Lincoln? Did they have a relationship?
Douglas did have a relationship with Lincoln, but not until the war years. Douglas first became aware of Lincoln during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He followed it in the newspapers, and Douglas was even out in Illinois during one or two of the debates.
And we should note this is not Lincoln versus Frederick Douglas.
Stephen Douglas,
right.
Yeah, for the Senate race in 1858. He became intrigued with Lincoln then, and of course, 2 years later, Lincoln runs for president. But their relationship was very testy at first. Douglas was one of Lincoln's most ferocious critics in the first year or year and a half of the war because the war wasn't being made against slavery, and they were even trying to return fugitive slaves. So before they ever met, Douglas had said some of the harshest things any critic of Lincoln had ever said.
But things changed over the course of the war?
I guess the
Emancipation Proclamation was probably critical there.
It was absolutely critical. Into 1862, Douglas was still hammering away at Lincoln. At one point, he called him the most powerful slave catcher in the country. But after the preliminary proclamation, September 62, and of course the final proclamation, January of 63, Douglas's tune on Lincoln greatly changed. And then especially with the recruiting of black soldiers in the wake of the Emancipation Proclamation, and Douglas got deeply involved personally in recruiting members of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. Two of his own sons were members of that regiment. He slowly but surely changes his tune about Lincoln. He comes to see the war now as a crusade led by Lincoln and the Republicans to not only save the Union, but do it by destroying slavery. He would everywhere he got a chance to say it, he would say, freedom to the slave is freedom to the nation. Freedom to the slave is the preservation of the Union.
You know, when he was a young abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, like William Lloyd Garrison, didn't think the U.S. Constitution could be used to grant true equality. He came to regard it differently and saw the Civil War as a chance for, in a way, a second American Revolution. And, of course, the question was whether the slaves in the South would truly be given the rights of citizenship. And in 1866, he leads a delegation of blacks to meet with Andrew Johnson, who had become president after Lincoln's assassination, himself essentially a white supremacist. What happens at this meeting?
It's an extraordinary meeting, and it's a debacle. Douglas leads his delegation, February 1866, of about 12 black men to the White House to meet with Johnson to talk to him about black civil and political rights. And because at that point, the nature of the Reconstruction laws and the soon-to-be 14th Amendment was all up in the air. The debates were just beginning to happen in Congress, and there was Andrew Johnson seemingly standing in the way of it all. And did he ever. They had a bitter and terrible exchange that lasted almost an hour. Andrew Johnson gave a speech to this delegation that Douglas led, a bitter speech. He blamed black people for the war. He told them they should really colonize themselves outside of the country. They should really leave. That political rights, especially the right to vote, were just never really going to be possible. And when Douglas tried at times to interrupt or interject, Johnson would tell him to be quiet and just listen. And they were forced, basically, to listen. Douglas finally, toward the end of this meeting, got in a few lines and a few questions. He demanded the right to vote. He said the right to vote for black people is ultimate peace and freedom to the whole country. But as they were leaving, Andrew Johnson was overheard saying, and it was recorded even in the newspaper, that Douglas, he's just like every other N-word I've ever known. He'll as soon cut your throat as anything. And Douglas overheard that. This is the president of the United States. Douglas then went back, and with his oldest son, Lewis, who was at this meeting, they wrote a kind of a manifesto letter that was published denouncing Andrew Johnson and protesting. But most importantly, Douglas did what he always did. He went to his desk and he wrote a barn burner of a speech. He called it The Perils to the Republic. It was a speech of warning, you know, that Andrew Johnson stands in the way here of the fruition of the victories of the Civil War. And he took that speech on the road in the summer of 1866. He's still giving it in 1867. And it has so many modern echoes today, especially the line where he says, "It is all well and good. Our Constitution and our laws are all well and good when a good man is president. But what do we do with our laws and our Constitution when a bad man is president?" He was, of course, referring to Andrew Johnson. But this is what's fascinating about that encounter is that it's at this moment of revolutionary change and all things seem possible about Reconstruction in the South and in the Constitution if it can be enacted, if it can be done over the veto power of the president. But it's quite an encounter, and there's really never been another meeting quite as bad between any other president and a delegation of black leaders.
Historian David Blight recorded in 2018. His Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, inspired a new HBO documentary which premiered this week. The film, which features several actors reading from Douglass's writings, is titled Frederick Douglass in Five Speeches. We'll hear more of my interview with David Blight after this short break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sattva. Sattva has 7 made-to-order mattresses that are designed to help every type of sleeper. Learn more at SAATVA.com. And from the American Lung Association. Comprehensive biomarker testing for lung cancer patients may lead to more treatment options. Learn more at lung.org/biomarker-testing.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. This week, HBO premiered a new documentary about the 19th century abolitionist and orator Frederick Douglass. Titled Frederick Douglass in Five Speeches, it features several distinguished actors reading from Douglass's writings. The documentary was inspired by the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Douglass by Yale historian David Blight. We're listening to my 2018 interview with Blight. His book is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Frederick Douglass is known as a real champion of women's suffrage. I think he was the only male speaker at the Seneca Falls meeting in 1848, right?
Yes, he's the only male speaker. He wasn't the only male signer of the Declaration of Sentiments at Seneca Falls, but he was the only black person even attending it.
Right.
He embraced women's suffrage early and often.
Except
he got into a big problem later.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. He right. befriended Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and in the end they had a falling out. It was over principle,
yes.
right? What happened?
Well, there were competing principles, of course. When it came time for the 15th Amendment, the Voting Rights Amendment, that passed in 1869, Douglass had a terrible falling out. with Susan Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who were the and others, but they were the two great leaders of the women's suffrage movement. And the whole debate was essentially about whether women would be included in the Voting Rights Amendment, and they were not. And the reason, of course, was that everyone with one eye open knew that if you put women's suffrage into that amendment, it never would have passed first the Congress and certainly wouldn't have passed in the state legislatures. So Douglas took the position that, it, as he put it, it was the black man's hour, and this was the one chance to get the right to vote for black men, and that for now women would have to once again wait. Well, Stanton and Anthony had run out of patience. They weren't going to wait any longer. But the problem was they pushed back and fought back with racist language, terribly racist language against Douglas and against black men generally. And Douglas handled most of that as a gentleman with grace, except he also threw about some rather stereotypical claims. For example, he said, well, educated women can still have their husbands voting and their husbands can vote their interest, which rings pretty badly on our ears today. But it was one of those moments when you had to make choices, and he took the choice of favoring the 15th Amendment because it got at least black male suffrage into the Constitution.
You know, he became committed to the Republican Party, and one of the most interesting things, I think, about the last half of your book is we see Frederick Douglass become a political insider. I mean, this right. guy who was a radical outsider, he gets patronage jobs. And the interesting thing is that as he embraces the Republican Party in the last half of the 19th century, it is a party that has essentially abandoned, you know,
yes.
the effort to grant blacks real citizenship in the South. It is becoming increasingly the party of big business.
Right.
You know, it's tariffs, it's free trade, it's anti-labor unions.
Right.
Does he go with all of that?
He goes along with it. He never gives up on the Republican Party. It can seem like a difficult thing to explain, but his usual explanation was he had nowhere else to go politically. He used to say, you know, the Republican Party is the ship and all else is the sea. There was no other political home for blacks. The problem was the Republican Party, as you say, moves away from enforcement of the Reconstruction Act, moves away from the Southern problem, moves away from enforcement of black voting rights and civil rights, and even moves away from enforcement against terrorist groups, for God's sake. It's a difficult thing for him, and he does levy some pretty brutal criticisms of the Republican Party over time, but it's from within the party. He always campaigned for the Republican candidate. He always said it is still the party of emancipation. It is still the party that saved the Union. And it must somehow find its way back to its creeds, even when it was pretty clear it was not. And this was, as I said, one of the disputes he has with a new generation of black leadership who is asking, should they remain loyal to a party that no longer really speaks for their interest?
In 1877, after this, well, in the later years of a very long and distinguished career, at which he is a very well-known and respected orator and writer, he goes to Maryland and tracks down his former master, Thomas Auld. What do we know of this meeting?
It's an amazing meeting. Thomas Auld, Douglas believed, was on his deathbed. He turned out not to die for roughly another year. But he went back to St. Michael's on the Eastern Shore, the very town in which Auld had held him as a teenage slave and beaten him, by the way, and then rented him out to other, you know, slaveholders at times as a field hand. But he went back, he met Auld with great publicity. He had press in tow. We have numerous, you know, press reports of this, which is how we know a fair amount about it. And he went to Auld's bed and they met for about 20 or 25 minutes. Douglas tells us they both shed tears. It was a kind of a meeting of epics and eras. By then, Auld, of course, knew how famous Douglas was. But Douglas quite directly appears to have asked Auld, are you my father? Or in some way, he asked him. He's trying to find out his birth, his paternity, his roots, and so on. But Auld did not say, yes, I'm your father. Maybe he couldn't. I don't know. And my own guess is that Auld is probably not his father, but that's a pure guess. Educated guess, I guess.
And did they talk about their relationship of ownership and bondage?
They did, and to some degree, according to Douglas, who is he's his own eyewitness for this, you have to remember. Yeah, they did, and I think Douglas also brought up the fact that he had befriended Auld's children, his daughter and son, just to try to understand, probably, whether they were actually kin. But even more importantly, on that visit, Douglas went over to Easton, Maryland, where he gave an incredible speech in an old black church, and then he went out to the Tuckahoe River, to the Horseshoe Bend, on a cold November day, dug his hands down in the soil where he believed his grandmother Betsy's cabin would have stood, trying to see if he could understand where in his imagination he could find his mother in that soil, where he could find his grandmother in that soil, how he could even understand who he was, and most importantly, he was always trying to understand how could a slave boy from that spot become who he became. How could a kid as a slave from that side of the Chesapeake cross the Chesapeake and become this world-class orator, writer, and thinker, and even statesman? He was always trying to even grasp and understand his own story as he kept telling it.
In a speech in 1875, he got a lot of attention when he seemed to sort of condemn some charitable efforts aimed at blacks and mm-hmm. kind of embraced the idea of black self-reliance. And this is which causes modern-day conservatives and even libertarians to claim him as one of their own. Yes. What was his view?
Well, he early and often favored self-reliance for his fellow black people. Virtually all black leaders in the 19th century preached a kind of self-reliance. What else could they do in a society that either enslaved them, segregated them, defined them out of the Constitution, and later on, of course, even used terror to eliminate them? So self-reliance was a matter of inevitable necessity in some ways. But what modern conservatives, as you said, especially the libertarians, have done is they've plucked out a speech from 1875, but many others too, before that and after that, where Douglas would answer the question, what does the Negro want, which was always bandied about, and his answer would be, let him alone, leave him alone. Let him alone, and he would say, give him fair play, which meant enforce the law, enforce his or her rights. Don't kill them when they're trying to vote and so forth. But what modern conservatives have done is they plucked out pieces of rhetoric here and there, and they've said, aha, you see, Douglas was not only a Republican, but he believed in individualism and self-reliance and self-help, which meant he didn't advocate for government assistance and so forth. I have to say, it's a terrible misuse and appropriation of Douglas because it ignores, I would argue, 80 or 90% of the rest of his ideas and the rest of his life. He was not anti-government in the least. He believed in activist, interventionist use of federal power to destroy slavery, to destroy the Confederacy, and to reconceive the U.S. Constitution. But it's what we do with historical figures. But it's often a rather slippery misuse of the past. He did preach self-reliance. There's no question about that. But you have to go back into that context and understand why.
David Blythe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Historian David Blythe, recorded in 2018. His Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, inspired a new HBO documentary about Douglass, which premiered this week. It's titled Frederick Douglass in 5 Speeches. Coming up, we remember physician and public health advocate Paul Farmer, who died Monday. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Casper, offering the Spring Capsule Collection, bedding designed with comfort and style in mind. Learn more at casper.com/promo. And from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant making and social investing. More at kresge.org.
This is Fresh Air. Paul Farmer, the physician and anthropologist known for his long-standing efforts to bring health care to some of the poorest people in the developing world, died Monday in Rwanda on the grounds of a hospital and university he helped establish. He was 62. Partners in Health, the global organization he helped found, said he died of an acute cardiac event. Farmer worked on public health projects in many countries, developing strategies for dealing with tuberculosis, HIV, and Ebola, in addition to providing basic, affordable care. When the New York Times contacted Dr. Anthony Fauci about Farmer's death, he wept in the interview, saying he and Farmer had been like soul brothers. Farmer had long-standing ties to Haiti, where he founded a clinic decades ago that would grow into a network of 16 medical centers around the country. We have a short excerpt of my interview with Farmer in 2011, after he'd been deeply involved in efforts to help Haiti recover from a devastating earthquake the year before. He'd written a book, one of 12 he authored, called Haiti After the Earthquake. Now, of course, one of the things that you note in the book is that improving health conditions in an impoverished place like Haiti is not just a matter of will and medical effort. It's a matter of dealing with, you know, the surrounding poverty and underdevelopment of the economy. And you write that the government of Haiti was often ignored by international relief agencies and non-governmental organizations. And you say it was known as the Republic of NGOs, meaning there were all of these aid organizations, all of them working around and ignoring the Haitian government itself, and that over time that undermined everyone's efforts. Give us an example of this and why it is harmful.
Well, let me give an example that's self-critique, because this is another thing I've learned in trying to write critically about NGOs, is that umbrage will be taken, and even the most constructive critique is difficult to get out there, in part because a lot of NGOs are defensive in posture, and I think you could do an analysis regarding why this would be so. They're struggling for what they regard as scarce resources. I understand all that. So to use our own example, Partners in Health has been working in Haiti for 25 years. In the first 10 or 15 years, I would say that we've got a lot of good work done with our Haitian colleagues. Again, this is all Haitian-led, built up an organization with a Haitian leadership. All the employees were Haitian, providing good medical services, or at least decent ones, but to a fairly restricted area. And we saw that as our medical efforts grew, at the same time, a lot of the public sector medical programs were failing in the same area. And so about 10 years ago, we said, well, what if we end up being guilty of what we're criticizing, that is, allowing the public health sector to collapse even as we grow? What if we're also guilty of that, and how could we make plan better so that we end up reinforcing public health and also public education? In Haiti, what had happened was the public sector was weak and underfunded, and people talked a lot about corruption and inability to get things done. And so they'd build these parallel systems, the NGOs, hence the Republic of NGOs. So what we did 10 years ago was to decide that all of our expansion would only occur in the public sector. So what that meant would be we wouldn't build our own hospitals or clinics, but rather rebuild or build public sector clinics and move our staff into those clinics and facilities and try to beef up the public sector that way. So this is not the only way to strengthen public health and public education in Haiti. It's just one way. And we've encouraged others to join us in this and make it less of a cosmetic effort. Now, after the earthquake, ironically, that argument got harder to make because the public sector was precisely the group most affected by the earthquake in terms of personnel, number of lives lost, but also infrastructure. So now it's even a greater challenge to work effectively with the government, and yet it's even more important to do so.
Help us understand why it doesn't work for private aid agencies and NGOs to come in and build their own network. I mean, if you go into Central Haiti and build your own clinic, you hire Haitians, you treat Haitians, you do good things, why isn't that just as good as the government doing it?
Well, you know, it can be just as good, but take the example of cholera again. Cholera exploded, as I said, like a bomb. It also exploded in some of the very areas where we were working hardest and longest. Well, and that is not because we weren't aware of the importance of clean water. It's that the NGO sector can't replace public works, and not in, you know, Philadelphia or Boston, and not in Rwanda or Haiti either. So for some services, you can have service providers that are not public. I mean, the Harvard teaching hospitals where I work are private, not-for-profit hospitals. So I'm not making some ideologically driven critique of private sector engagement. It's just to say there needs to be some public safety net. And I think that's especially true for the poorest, because after all, an NGO doesn't have a mandate, a legal mandate, to provide basic access to health and education and clean water for the citizenry of Haiti or the citizenry of Honduras or the United States. Really, that's a public sector pact to provide these services. The majority of education in Haiti, probably 85% of primary and secondary education in Haiti, is private. And I think it's not an accident that that system is so privatized, and Haiti is also the country with the highest rates of illiteracy in the hemisphere. So there's this connection, I think.
It also strikes me that you're somebody who's been really effective at building effective medical treatment facilities in a lot of places. And in this role as a UN Special Deputy Envoy, you're having to tackle the bigger, broader stuff, economic development issues. I mean, how you govern a country. Are you going to stay with that, or do you want to get back to something that's more in your field?
I would very much like to get back to direct delivery of medical care and really to focus on rebuilding in the healthcare sector and also in training physicians and nurses. I am full of respect for people who try to take on these big development questions inside government and outside. And but the satisfactions that one gets in direct service are quite gratifying emotionally and personally. And so I think for me, making sure that there's enough of my time spent on teaching and delivering care is really going to keep me in this for the long run. And I think most of my coworkers, including my Haitian coworkers, feel the same way, that sometimes when the big picture is just overwhelming or daunting or discouraging, there's always the possibility of the little picture. That is responding to a problem. I mean, it's not like cholera is a little problem. Cholera is a huge problem. But it is within our reach, I think, to improve the quality of services offered to people with cholera and the quality of preventive services in a region. And so I'm going to try and do both those things, and many of my coworkers are doing that as well.
Paul Farmer recorded in 2011. Farmer died Monday. He was 62. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the new film Cyrano, a musical based on the Cyrano de Bergerac story starring Peter Dinklage. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The famous story of Cyrano de Bergerac has been adapted for the screen many times since the play was first staged in 1897. The latest film version, called Cyrano, is a musical starring Peter Dinklage in the title role. It's directed by Joe Wright, whose other films include Pride and Prejudice and Atonement. Cyrano opens in theaters this week. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
A lot of great actors have played Cyrano de Bergerac over the years, including José Ferrer, Christopher Plummer, Gérard Depardieu, Kevin Kline, and Steve Martin, if you count, and why not, the 1987 modern-day comedy Roxanne. The latest to join their distinguished company is Peter Dinklage, and he's the rare actor not to wear a fake nose for the role. Here, it's not a big schnoz, but rather Cyrano's diminutive stature that makes him think he's unworthy of Roxanne, the woman he loves, played by Hayley Bennett. That's not the only major departure from Edmond Rostand's tragicomic 1897 play. This solid and sometimes enchanting movie, simply titled Cyrano, was adapted by Erika Schmidt from her 2019 stage musical with a score and songs by members of the band The National. Their sweet, somber melodies bring a decidedly modern edge to the story, which takes place sometime between the 17th and 18th centuries. While Cyrano de Bergerac usually unfolds in Paris, the movie, shot mostly in Sicily, doesn't specify an exact location. Apart from those changes, it's the same story. Cyrano, a respected soldier in the king's army, is renowned and feared for his superb swordsmanship and his scathing wit, both of which have made him powerful enemies, like Count de Guiche, played by a scowling Ben Mendelsohn. Cyrano is also deeply in love with Roxanne, a longtime friend who admires his confrontational spirit and his way with words. But Roxanne has fallen for Christian, a dashing young soldier, played by a very good Kelvin Harrison Jr., who's just joined Cyrano's regiment. Cyrano takes on the role of a go-between, and even goes so far as to write impossibly eloquent love letters to Roxanne, passing them off as Christians. At the climax of this farcical romantic triangle, Roxanne stands at her bedroom window while the hopelessly inarticulate Christian tries to woo her, with some much-needed prodding from Cyrano lurking in the shadows. At a certain point, Cyrano takes over, and he gives full voice to his passionate feelings in this lovely duet between him and a still unsuspecting Roxanne.
Your letters to me are like music.
They're just a mask in a lonely coward's game.
What is it you're so afraid of?
I might lose everything if I lose the pain. 'Cause every time I see you, I am overcome.
It makes you laugh to think someone like me could keep someone like you.
Look what I've become.
Fun fact, Peter Dinklage and screenwriter Erika Schmidt are a couple, as are Hayley Bennett and the film's director, Joe Wright. Think of it as a romantic behind-the-scenes footnote to a movie that's unabashedly romantic in spirit. Wright's filmmaking has a pleasing old-fashioned sumptuousness, courtesy of production designer Sarah Greenwood and costume designers Massimo Cantini-Parini and Jacqueline Duran, who are Oscar-nominated for their dazzling work here. And as always, Wright controls the camera with fluid grace, letting us see the actors and dancers moving through space, with none of the busy cutting you get in so many contemporary movie musicals. Bennett is a trained singer, and she delivers the movie's strongest musical performance. Her Roxanne really comes to emotional life when she's called on to sing. Dinklage has musical experience, too. He was the frontman of a 90s punk band called Wizzy, and he expresses Cyrano's every longing with a deep, soulful baritone. He's an inspired choice for the role. Like Tyrion Lannister, whom Dinklage played to perfection on Game of Thrones, Cyrano is always the smartest person in the room, easy to underestimate, but hard to defeat in a battle of wits or weapons. But Dinklage shows you the deep ache at Cyrano's core and makes you feel the sting of his unrequited love. Some purists may miss that big nose, but there's something about the lack of prosthetic enhancements that makes Dinklage's performance all the more poignant. What you see on screen is all him, nothing more and nothing less. That disarming sincerity applies to the movie as a whole. It's not always the most graceful retelling of this oft-told tale, but it's hard not to admire Wright's conviction, and sometimes his crazy audacity. Only a truly committed director would have opted to shoot a climactic battle scene at 16,000 feet above sea level, on the side of Mount Etna, a live volcano. It's a showy flourish, for sure, but also a fitting one for a story of such grand operatic passion.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Cyrano, starring Peter Dinklage. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
I have a wife I haven't seen since lilacs bloomed in St. Hippolyte. She always wears them.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, a hiring platform designed to streamline the candidate search process. Businesses attract, screen, and interview candidates all from the employer dashboard. More at Indeed.com/NPR. And from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to making privacy online simple. Used by tens of millions, they offer private search and tracker blocking with one download. DuckDuckGo. Privacy simplified.